So, she said, I'm a cancer epidemiologist. My area is doing the sequencing of the early lung to determine RNA, DNA events, and immunologic events that push people who are at high risk to cancer. But I got a job. I asked for the job to direct screening and survivorship because from a clinical side, this is really a big need, and Roswell needed to kind of come into the future. And so we're going to talk a little bit. I got asked to do this on Tuesday. The person had great slides from last year. I've incorporated some of those. They're not the clearest slides in the world, but they are good summaries. And I'm happy to forward last year's. I think they're already on the website. It's a very comprehensive set of slides that she had and about diet and things like that. So I would encourage you to look at that. I will find a paper for you to read. And because I am in, I'm going to ask some questions from the paper. I'm just telling you that right now. But I know that's something you're going to be thinking about if I ask you to read something. But anyway, I want to run this informally, so if you have a question about what I'm talking about, please interrupt. I do use clinical references because I was an ICU nurse for a long time, and so that's one of the reasons why I can competently start a clinical program, and hopefully research will grow from there. But the other thing is we need to talk about survivors. So, I don't know anything about you guys. How many of you are kind of on the basic science tracks? You know, like immunology, genetics, all of you. Is anyone in population science? Okay. Why do we need to talk about survivorship? It's obvious for you two, maybe, if it will be, but for the rest of you, why do we talk about survivorship? And why aren't we just talking about tumors? And part of it is because we are really making progress on a lot of tumors. And it's great. And the problem is we can address one tumor. We can address one tumor and the patient lives and they live long enough to get a second tumor, either of the same type or of a different type. And so as we go forward, we have to not only treat patients in a way that if they survive, they're not going to spend the rest of their life suffering from what we did to them to treat their primary tumor. And we have to start anticipating how tumors get around treatment. So what you study in a mouse model or in a cell line or in the epidemiology is really relevant to survivorship. Because if we do our job, we kill the primary tumor, or at least we get it to stop growing. Because we want to turn cancer into a chronic disease. We're doing some really great stuff with immunology, with the checkpoint inhibitors and the CAR T cells, and they are not necessarily going to get rid of all the cancer, but they're going to let the patient live, and that's survivorship. How do we keep them alive after that, and how do we help them maintain a good quality of life? These are issues. But for you guys, it's these resistance pathways that tumors develop that, you know, eventually will kill the patient. And, you know, no matter which area you're in, the goal is to keep cancer patients alive and going back to, a productive life. We can never lose sight of that. So some of this is going to seem pretty applied, like to the clinic. NCI defines survivorship from the minute you're diagnosed, because a lot of the issues that you experience while you're having your cancer treatment are very similar, a similar reflection of what happens after you're treated and you go on. But from the time you're diagnosed, it covers the multiplicity of factors in a life, from physical consequences of treatment to psychological stressors, life-threatening illnesses, and the challenges of finances and families, and the forced redefinition of life. So, you know,
eventually someone you know is going to get cancer, and you are going to understand that as soon as they say you have cancer, it something their life changes, and it changes forever. You don't ever talk to a breast cancer survivor who's 50 years out and say they are a cancer survivor. They never lose that label. They may look completely normal, but you carry cancer with you for the rest of your life from that one minute you're diagnosed. So these are some of the slides I adapted. They're a little fuzzy, but... So why is survivorship more of an issue? Because we are getting better at diagnosing and treating people earlier, and a number of them live in a disease-free state for a long period of time. So I'm going to introduce this concept of like a young adult cancer patient. So we know they're different. They didn't have a lifetime of exposures from their environment. They get cancer early. Most likely it has a heavier genetic burden to it. Sometimes their tumors look different. When they are finished treatment and you follow them, you treat them like they're kids if they're under the age of 40 instead of adults, because a lot of the consequences are similar to pediatrics. But you can have people who live post-treatment of their initial tumor for 50 years. I mean, that's the ideal. But even 10 years, even 15 years. So, you know, again, that treatment, what you did to them on a cellular level, they take with them into their life, and it can be a long time. We're advancing screening. We're looking for biomarkers in the blood that will pick cancers up when they are microscopic or micrometastatic. And again, while we have these great advances, and we have to treat people less, and we actually cure them, it really still impacts their quality of life and their length of survival. And, we know for most cancers, I was in a meeting the other day about pancreatic cancer and liver cancer that we really consider to be fatal, you know. If you pick them up early, you can do resections, and they can still live many years after a pancreatic or a liver cancer resection and with adjuvant therapy. So there's a lot that can happen. So who are they? They're people obviously diagnosed, family members and friends and caregivers are also affected by treatment, and we consider them members of the survivorship family or experience. In practice, the concept of survivorship is usually, you know, who we see in our program are people who finish treatment. And, you know, we'll talk about some of the sequelae of cancer treatment, but the earlier we get them into proactive survivorship care, the better the quality of life they have going forward, and especially with surveillance, the more likely we are to pick up a recurrence early so that they don't die of a second cancer. So those are the phases of survivorship. And so how do they become survivors? Well, people get treated and then they're cancer-free, and they have more than one treatment. People can have multiple complications. So there are a range of experiences for survivors. Like they can be cancer-free from lymphoma. They're at 5 times the increased risk of a second primary. That's a solid tumor. So they will eventually... So they can go on here and find a complication or a second cancer. They can die much longer after a late recurrence. With lung cancer, where we're really seeing the trends change and we're having effective treatments, especially with checkpoint inhibitors, people are living longer, but we know because of our inability to really wipe this cancer out and to change the lung airway that eventually they'll die from a late recurrence. Again, second cancers is really a big issue from a psychological standpoint, but also, you know, this week in a GYN, so if somebody survived ovarian cancer, which has usually a very bad prognosis, and then we picked up a very early breast cancer, because people who have cancer have a propensity to develop other cancers, and they often survive the first or second. We have someone coming in tomorrow who's on her third solid tumor. And then there are intermittent periods where they may recur, they may get cured, they're a survivor, they have a second cancer, and then you know, people who, after their very first treatment, are cancer-free for the duration, and they never recur, and they never really have big side effects. The numbers of survivors are continuing to grow. We have about a little over 15.5 million survivors right now. It represents just 5% of the population. That will get up to 20 million by 2026, and 26 million by two. So this is this is the part of her slides which I couldn't do anything about. But we are really seeing rapid growing. Now, one thing to remember is we have an aging population. And, you know, the average age for lung cancer, say, diagnosis is 70. For pancreatic cancer, it's 60. And so when people get over their first cancer, you know, it's closer to 50s for lymphoma. But they age. And so the aging population, you know, age is the single greatest risk factor for cancer, just so you know. So the older people are, the more likely they are to have a sporadic cancer just by chance. And so age definitely comes into this. So we see a lot in this older age group. And here's a display of that. You know, the biggest categories are the 60 to 69, 70 to 79, 80. That's three quarters of the distribution of who survivors are by age. And, you know, again, that's where most of the cancers are. We're looking at 50 to 59 is 15%. Here, these are considered the young adult ranges. So we're still, you know, looking at 6 to 8% of survivors are young adults. And then pediatric cases are, you know, relatively small. So, you know, what do survivors tell us? They tell us that they have a lot of pain, and, you know, a good portion of that is just attributed to the cancer itself. They have a lot of numbness, urinary incontinence, because, again, prostate cancer is probably the bigger single cause of that. And so we know they have a lot of bowel incontinence for any GI. A lot of times it happens during chemo, vision problems. You know, these are the main symptoms. And, again, these don't look so bad, but imagine... like I have a husband who is a stage 4 colon cancer survivor, and he got oxaliplatin, and he doesn't do touch screens very well. He has to have a thing. And 3.5 years later, it hasn't gotten any better. He's of a subgroup. We know if they have it after a year, they're likely to have it permanently. And so, you know, fortunately, he's a photographer with digital photography and doesn't have to do any fine motor skills. But when you figure out that most breast cancer patients, colon cancer patients, lung cancer patients get some platinum at some time, that's a lot of people walking around not being able to use their iPhones very well. The other part, and this is a really big area of research, I don't know if, you know, with Andre Gudkoff's group that are looking at the age influencing senescence of cells and how our many systems in our body stop working as efficiently. And so as you, you know, kind of get into this period, you can see from a pathway standpoint that there are a lot of pathways that get affected with age. You know, DNA repair, genomic instability is increased. You know, you have altered intracellular communication, from many proteases, epigenetic alterations accumulate. Those are related to a lot of cancer formation. And so as we age, some of the best defenses that we have against forming cancer also age. And so when you're looking at a survivor population who may have had cytotoxic drugs, as they get older, as these pathways shut down, you see why there's this problem of second primaries. So concerns that cancer patients have that are unmet, side effects and symptom management. You know, these are pretty significant. Psychosocial, interpersonal, and emotional support. Health promotion. So you live, and you don't want to necessarily continue the life that you had before you got cancer, because in many cases, especially with colon and lung, and that may have been associated with why you got the cancer. And so, but we don't, you know, typically, and that's not just here, that's across the country, these things are not mentioned. And why are they not mentioned? Because they're going to an oncologist. Their job is to get rid of the tumor. They are not specifically trained. They don't necessarily have the infrastructure in their treatment facilities to start dealing with what the patient carries forward after cancer treatment. And so, you know, there, in terms of caregivers, we're looking at people. Whoa. That's not me, right? That's shaking?
No.
Okay. Great. 5 years out, we're still looking at unmet needs by the family. And, you know, I want to just talk a little bit about financial toxicity, is that cancer is expensive. Even if you have great health insurance, you lose time from work. People who go under bone marrow transplant, we know that it used to be 2 years before the wave of financial insecurity hit. Now it's within 6 months. Families mortgage their homes. They take out loans. They'll do anything to support that treatment. And, you know, it's a really big burden on the family. And, you know, if you're dealing with a kid with leukemia, you know, and they have all the side effects that you get from surviving a childhood cancer, then you also look at toxicity when they graduate from college and go to get jobs and things like that. And so finances, and especially in this healthcare, this insecure healthcare environment that we currently have, finances are a problem. Why is that important? If you're a lymphoma, childhood lymphoma patient, and you skip a drug, the number of times of doses that you skip is directly associated with how well you do. So if it's a decision between rent and a pill, and you skip the pill, you're essentially not going to do as well on your treatment. And, you know, there's been some really great studies. We have one going on out here. But again, it just shows you the impact that it has on the family for a long period of time. So, you know, this is a slide just looking at the stage distribution for breast cancer and the great things. We have a very effective screening modality with mammogram, and the majority of cases are in the localized or, you know, regional state. Very few are metastatic, and what you would expect and what you see with breast cancer is that they have a very high survival rate. You know, for those of us who deal with lung cancer, we would dream to even get, you know, half of this. But again, with breast cancer, stage matters. Okay, it's not always the, you know, people come back. I met a woman recently who'd had her first breast cancer 50 years ago, and her second breast cancer was at the age of 75. So they never really are free of the cancer. What happens to breast cancer patients? Well, when you go and dissect lymph nodes, you develop a lymphedema, which is the accumulation of lymph fluid in the arm, in the chest, in the back. If you had lymph nodes for some reason dissected on the lower extremities, you can frequently get people who, you know, if they've had GYN cancer, cervical cancer, colon cancer, they often get fluid collecting in their legs. If it's not treated early, it's a permanent. And you see women with these pressure sleeves. It's really debilitating. It's painful. And again, 20% of patients develop lymphedema. They've tried to, you know, how they dissect lymph nodes and all of that. And if they undergo a sentinel lymph node biopsy, which is taking the lymph node that's closest to the tumor to see if there's any micrometastasis, 6% of them get lymphedema, tightness, stretching of the chest wall. 25 and 60% of women develop chronic pain as a result, because as the swelling happens, blood flow is impinged. And, you know, so this is a pretty significant side effect. Certain drugs like anthracyclines or HER2-targeted drugs can cause, in addition to women getting lymphedema, cardiomyopathies and congestive heart failure. For, you know, 3.3 million men living with a history of prostate cancer in the U.S., again, this is a very successful, you know, treatment. The majority are localized. Most of the localized and regional prostate cancers survive a long time. They die of something else. We no longer do just PSA screening because it was leading to a lot of unnecessary interventions. So now men have digital rectal exams, as well as discussion about having a PSA done. You know, again, stage does matter, and there's a 10 to 15 year survival rate is 98% and 95% respectively. Some of the concerns with prostate cancer survivors: incontinence, erectile dysfunction, bowel complications. 95% of patients undergo surgery and receive radiation have some kind of sexual dysfunction. 50% report urinary or bowel incontinence. So you take somebody who looks completely normal, and this is a really common cancer, and you know, just imagine this for the last 30 years of their lives. And if they're on androgen deprivation therapy, which essentially starves their body of androgens, they take on a lot of estrogen-like symptoms with breast growth, loss of facial hair, emotional instability. They also are at increased risk for muscle deterioration, nutritional compromise, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obesity. So not trivial, and that's one of the reasons why if you don't need to treat a prostate cancer, the trend now is not to treat it, but just to watchfully wait and watch the cancer, because the side effects of treatment are substantial. The other part I have to say is that 89% of patients report that they have never had a discussion of sexual dysfunction with any provider throughout their whole life. So you know, maybe it's not necessary, but when you've had prostate cancer, it's definitely necessary. When you have colon cancer, it's necessary. When you have a breast removed, when you have your salivary glands taken. You know, so there's a lot of patients who really need these discussions, and so I playfully say, when somebody says, why should I send my newly, you know, treated patient to survivorship, you know, what do you offer that I don't offer? And I say, you know, we offer integrated medicine, we offer, acupuncture, we offer sexual dysfunction counseling. And they say, okay, because they know it needs to be done, but they don't do it. And, you know, that's the right thing. Okay, so with childhood cancers, we're going to get to some of the long-term symptoms, but I did not realize this. You know, I do lung cancer. Maybe, you know, I'm an epidemiologist, so I had to learn something about other cancers. Okay, so with the childhood cancers, I don't know if you've ever known anybody who's had a childhood cancer and they survive. It's great. They're treated with less high dose drugs than they used to be. The radiation is much more confined than it used to be. But 50% of childhood cancer survivors develop a severe, life-threatening, chronic health condition by the age of 50. And they develop second cancers like breast, brain, thyroid, myeloma, acute myeloid leukemia. And so I didn't really realize this until I started to take this job. If they've had radiation to the brain or the spine, it can slow their growth. And so oftentimes you see childhood cancer survivors with some kind of physical stunting. If they get chest radiation, they can have heart problems. They face challenges related to insurance coverage. There are some delays in puberty. There are some definite delays in cognition development, partly because they were removed from a normal environment as a kid, and partly because the effect of maybe brain radiation on their cognitive development. So, you know, this paints an awkward picture. I don't think it's there are a lot of symptoms that need to be managed to give cancer survivors a good quality of life and a better functional status, enabling them to complete treatment, but also to go on with their lives. So I'm going to talk about a few of these main side effects that they have from treatment. This is obviously my slide. And so in building our program, our philosophy is that we have to support the patient and family. We have to individualize survivorship care. So if it means doing echocardiographs or doing more intense screening regimen, if it means looking for mutations if they develop a second tumor, if it means getting exercise and nutrition changes, we really individualize to the patient. We want to maximize health and wellness for every survivor and support them and their family so that they can get past this event and to improve their quality of life and for their support networks. Because, you know, I know from my personal experience and I know from the experience of many, many patients that cancer is a family disease. It impacts everybody, whether it's your kid who worries about a parent dying or whether it's your kid, that this is an emotional and draining and physically challenging event for an entire group. That doesn't work. Okay, so pain. You know, and I'm going to go through these fast, but, you know, it's the most common symptom associated with cancer and has one of the highest impacts on quality of life. Chronic pain is associated with depression. We know that people who are depressed after cancer have a, you know, threefold increased risk of dying prematurely from other causes. So that treating that depression, identifying it early, is important, as well as treating the pain. So, you know, 33% of patients really experience pain that needs treatment after being treated for cancer. Fatigue. So, you know, you have your cancer treatment, you go home, you can't get out of bed, you feel like you don't have any energy anymore. It's related to a lot of different things: anemia, depression, you know, chronic inflammatory processes that are just part of a response to the cancer treatment. You also have maybe muscle loss from the treatment, depending on how long it is. We know that moderate to intensity resistance exercise reduces cancer-related fatigue. So what we tell our patients coming out of treatment is exercise. 20-minute walk, exercise, exercise. What we tell people undergoing treatment, exercise. 20 minutes of walking around the block while you're getting chemo, radiation. After surgery, we know they do better. A big trend right now is called prehabilitation. So you exercise people, you get them on a good nutritional regime before they're in surgery, because we know that has a direct relationship to side effects coming out of surgery. But, you know, this is a great area of study. Like, how much exercise? Who do we direct it at? What stage? And how does it relate to their treatment, their stage of cancer? How to really make improvements in their levels of fatigue? And so we have several studies going on right now and more planned to look at the benefits from exercise. We also know that you can improve lung function, which means less side effects during surgery. So this is a very important area. Okay. So have you heard of chemo brain? Have you ever heard that expression? Okay, so what it really means is that there is some cognitive deficit when you've either had radiation or you've had chemo. Like a few days after chemo, you know, you feel stupid, you're flushed, you have all these things, you can't read books. Sometimes I ran into a lung cancer survivor 10 years out, and she hasn't been reading in 10 years. And so we did an assessment on her, and she also went to a someone who did a neurocognitive assessment. And they determined that the treatment had unmasked some ADHD. And so they put her on those drugs, and she was starting to read again. But, you know, like 10 years out, the problem's finally resolved, that she could read a book. And she was a, you know, insurance company executive and, you know, stuff like that. So having had treatment really had an effect on her lifestyle. It can go on for a long time. The trends in the literature right now are to use some treatment like they did to do a proper assessment, which is easy to administer in the clinic, and then to identify those areas. There are things, there's therapy you can do, psychosocial therapy, to start to recover your cognitive function. But, you know, again, it is a real problem. It's a complaint that most cancer patients complain of at some point. And, you know, it affects the long-term ability to work. Can you go back to your job? You know, things like that. So fear of recurrence. So they have something called scanxiety. So every time you go in for that follow-up CT, you're a mess, you make your family anxious, and you just need to have a CT and have your doctor come in and say, no cancer, or the tumor hasn't changed. So from a psychological standpoint, this is really a big factor for survivors, and rightfully so. Heart damage. So I was pretty shocked. Chemotherapy drugs, particularly anthracyclines, cause heart damage, and that may not show itself until 10, 15, 20 years, sometimes 30 years after treatment. So you have to know who got treated with these drugs, how much did they get. We calculated in a lifetime dose, and then we begin to monitor people getting echoes when they come in, looking at signs of congestive heart failure. It's really reduced the risk of cardiac problems if they develop healthier things like exercise and nutrition after treatment. So you, just like with any cardiac problem, if you develop a healthy lifestyle, you can start to put off the onset of these symptoms. But one thing we're finding is that most kids who are treated as kids don't know that this is going to be a problem. They have no clue that they need to see a doctor on a regular basis, or that they need a colonoscopy at 25, or that they should never not report that they're a leukemia or lymphoma survivor. Now, a lot of adults also get these drugs, and it's important to know when to know how much you got. So education is a big thing. Infertility. So if you're going to have a bone marrow transplant, you're not going to do great having kids afterwards. There is this chance that you do not have viable sperm or eggs. And so, and it's the same with a lot of leukemia treatments, lymphoma treatments, depends on where you get your radiation, obviously, if you have a GYN cancer. And so we have a program here where we help people with IVF. We get sperm samples and bank them away. And, because what we find now is that because the word has not been out, a lot of 30-somethings figure out that the treatment they got when they were 5 made them infertile, and they didn't realize that. And I was at in San Francisco with my nephew, and he was talking about his friend adopting. And I said, well, why, he's adopting. He goes, yeah, he was treated for leukemia, and he didn't realize until he was married and they went in for fertility counseling that the lymphoma that he was treated for made him infertile. That's a pretty big knowledge deficit. So we clearly are not getting the message out. It wouldn't change how you were treated necessarily. We are using different doses of drugs and confining where radiation. We're much better at that, but still fertility persists. So survivorship is a multifaceted thing. It's both from a clinical standpoint, we need to help manage these symptoms. We need to really push some of the support services like nutrition and PT and psych and social work, because patients really need this. This is a complex period of their lives. Cancer screening, obviously, for capturing these second primaries, for identifying it based on their original tumor or tumors, which screening tests they need. And again, sounds kind of straightforward, like you survived, so you still have breasts, so you should still get a mammogram. And I can tell you that if you survive a big cancer, you do not want to get another cancer. I think those tumors from a molecular standpoint are super interesting, because this is, where it's second cancers, was it related to the treatment? There's a genomic propensity for it. We know that there are mutations that increase risk of second primaries, but most people don't have those. But it's really hard from a psychology standpoint to get someone to get screened. It would be tragic that you survive ovarian cancer and you die of breast cancer, because, you could prevent it or pick it up early. But that is the psychology of cancer survivors. And again, most lymphoma patients do not know their level of risk for a second primary. Most, African Americans don't know that they're at an increased risk for most cancers, and especially if they've been treated for a primary cancer, they are really at a super high risk for a second primary. And then there are integrated therapies. And I know I got interviewed the other day by somebody from the Buffalo News about integrated therapies, you know, like how do you deal with all the resistance, you know, coming from a place like Roswell. And there are a lot of integrated therapies that have an evidence base. You know, I spent 20 years looking at selenium and cancer prevention, which has a really good basic science evidence base. We have to focus on those that have an evidence base, just like we focus on drugs and treatments that have an evidence base. The fact is that 80% of people undergoing treatment use some form of integrated medicine, whether it's tea, whether it's vitamins, whether it's acupuncture, massage. 80% do it, and about 30% tell their doctor they do it. Now, if they do anything, you know, if you're taking vitamins, if they're doing anything, it may counteract, decrease the efficacy of your treatment. We know this is true with antioxidants and radiation therapy. But the other part is that your caregiver who's supposed to be, who's injecting you or treating you with really substantial treatments should know what you're actually taking. Now, why don't they do that? Because they don't get the message that that's okay to report it. They don't want to hear, oh, that does nothing. Because maybe their cancer treatment is not going to save them. So it's a contradiction, and psychologically it is not straightforward for patients. But we do know they are frequently used. And why are they used? Because patients want to have control over some aspect of their life. You know, you're getting chemo and radiation, you had surgery, you've given up a whole lot. They want to have control, and they don't necessarily want drugs to treat every symptom. And I think that's very valid. If you can go to an acupuncturist who treats your pain and you don't have to use an opioid, I don't see what the problem is with that. Pain is pain. But, you know, we do know that this is kind of a touchy area, but that if you focus on evidence-based treatments that are published in the same literature that everything else is published in, and we know that they don't change the efficacy of the cancer treatment, then I think that we're okay. It's when we don't address it with patients and they start to use something that's wacky and that interferes with the efficacy of their treatment and they don't tell anyone. And that's what we really have to avoid. So what happens in survivorship, separate from oncology, is that we see patients once or twice a year. We assess the symptoms, the physical, mental, and emotional health of the patient. We assess their lifestyle, provide referrals to support services, do a lot of education if we can. We support communication with a primary care doctor so that if you're on tamoxifen after breast cancer treatment, which is a hormone, you have to have your blood lipids measured. The likelihood of a breast cancer patient dying of cardiovascular events because their lipids are out of control is greater than them of dying of a recurrent breast cancer. And so we have to communicate with the primary care because they obviously have to do some monitoring. We have to provide comprehensive screening, and we have to get people into research. Because with 20-plus million people in our, while I'm still working, there's going to be 20 million survivors. This is a population that we have to understand, and we have to know how to intervene, especially as they grow older, because that just complicates things more. So these are just kind of a list of sort of the services that we need to make available. And I, just because I can't help myself, with smoking, regardless of where the tumor is, smokers continue to smoke. There is at no point in their lives where quitting smoking is not a benefit. It's a benefit. We know that people who quit smoking after they're diagnosed with lung cancer live significantly longer than patients who continue to smoke. And that effect is about as big as any drug that we have on the market now. So it extends their life as much as any effective treatment right now. So quitting smoking at any point is a benefit. There's a lot of services and quit line and personal counseling, but smoking continues to drive this carcinogenic process. E-cigarettes are not necessarily a great benefit, and I was at a study section and someone said, well, it helps people quit. There's no evidence that continuing to be dosed on e-cigarettes helps people quit, or that it's a harm reduction. We don't know that, because you're still inhaling stuff. And so if you have a problem with DNA repair and you keep inhaling stuff, you may still have a problem with DNA repair, even if it comes from an e-cigarette. So the word is still out there on e-cigarettes. But any smoking at any point in their life, they immediately start to see benefit. We know that smoking retards the efficacy of radiation therapy. We're not exactly sure why. We know that it retards the effect of chemotherapy. We know that it retards wound healing. That's it. So if you have somebody you can talk to quit smoking, it doesn't matter what their diagnosis is. It's just better. Again, this is kind of blurry, but this is a complex period, that you probably hadn't really thought about. But there are a lot of effects, and again, getting people into understanding the diseases and the symptoms they're at risk for, helping them to change their lifestyle to prevent, with exercise and nutrition and meditation and yoga or whatever it is they want, family therapy, financial counseling, to sort of ease this period, the anxiety caused, because, again, we know that how they feel during this period of survivorship affects their long-term prognosis. This is just my slide because I thought it was a little clearer, not great, but, there are a lot of things to consider survivorship. So, for example, we got funds to run nutrition classes for healthy eating. We have a mindfulness program that's starting next month. We have free yoga for survivors, caregivers, and employees now that's starting up and will run for throughout the year. Education classes on genetic risk, prevention, lifestyle change. And that's my group when we go out for happy hour, but that's it. Oh God, they're gonna be mad if I leave that up. Okay, so do you have any questions? Okay. Thanks.